From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. This weekend may lead us closer to peace or to an escalating war in the former Yugoslavia. Talks will resume between the warring factions while President Clinton decides on his policy on military intervention. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with the BBC's Misha Glennie, who is covering the war. He says military intervention will only lead to a wider, bloodier war. Also, we talk with two writers, one from Sarajevo, the other from Belgrade, who have just received the Freedom to Write Award from PEN, the International Writers Organization. Both are living in exile now in Slovenia. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Bound by Honor. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton said today that he's hopeful that talk of military strikes may have forced the Bosnian Serbs to reconsider a UN-backed peace plan in the region. The president said he's nearing a decision on additional action in the former Yugoslavia. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
President Clinton said today in New Orleans that public discussion of a more forceful response to the ethnic violence may have caused Bosnian Serbs to take another look at the plan they rejected last week. In addition to reconsidering the plan, they've also agreed to meet this weekend in Athens with other warring parties. President Clinton says he'll summon his national security advisors to the White House tomorrow morning for another assessment before making additional telephone calls to allied leaders and members of Congress. A decision is expected after the meeting. Vice President Al Gore said on two morning television programs today that it's premature to suggest whether the president will advocate airstrikes or lifting of the arms embargo against Bosnian Muslims. The president has publicly insisted that he is not considering the use of ground troops and that action that includes the United States must be multilateral. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic said today that he doesn't expect to sign an agreement when Yugoslav peace talks resume this weekend in Athens. Instead, Karadzic said that he'd push for territorial concessions to connect Serbian-controlled areas in northern and eastern Bosnia. The Bosnian Serb leader told reporters that Serbs are fighting for the contiguity of their territory and the safety of their people. The plan to resume UN-sponsored peace talks came in response to a decision by the self-proclaimed Bosnian Serb parliament to reconsider the Vance-Owen peace plan. The Serbs have rejected the plan twice in the past. A top Air Force general lost his job today for his role in the troubled C-17 air cargo jet program. Two other generals and a high-ranking Pentagon civilian employee were also disciplined. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Secretary of Defense Les Aspin ordered that Major General Michael Butchko be relieved as commander of the Air Force Development Test Center. The C-17, built by McDonnell Douglas, is slated to be the next-generation air transport jet, but the plane has a long history of problems. Last October, its wings broke during a stress test, and cost overruns have reached $1.5 billion. Last January, the Pentagon's Deputy Inspector General recommended disciplinary action against several Air Force officials for making premature payments of $442 million to McDonnell Douglas. The inspector general charged that the aircraft company was in severe financial trouble and needed the cash. Aspin said in a memo that he moved against the generals because they had failed to acknowledge problems and act decisively. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The Dow Jones Industrials gained 2 points today. This is NPR News. General Motors served notice today that it will challenge the government's claim that GM pickup trucks with side-mounted gas tanks are unsafe. The automaker formally declined a federal request to voluntarily recall the trucks built from 1973 to 1987. Critics blame the side-mounted tanks for some 200 deaths, allegedly caused by fires that broke out when the trucks were involved in broadside collisions. Earlier this month, federal safety officials asked GM to voluntarily recall 4.7 million of the trucks. The crew of the shuttle Columbia continues its work in space today. The seven-member team is awaiting word on when it will return to Earth. Dave Pignanelli of member station WMFE reports.
Controllers in Houston say a decision on whether to extend this research mission will more than likely be made on Sunday. Currently, the space shuttle and its crew are scheduled for landing on Wednesday. The decision to extend will be in the hands of flight controllers in Houston, along with the mission management team. Added to the mix will also be the payload team, made up of scientists working out of Germany. This is a German research mission, and scientists will need enough time to prepare the Space Lab module for the flight back home. Mission managers will also base their decision on whether there is enough electricity to power the Space Lab experiments for one more day. The crew has been trying to conserve as much power as possible. For National Public Radio, I'm Dave Pignanelli reporting.
U.S. Trade Representative Mickey Cantor cited three countries today for violations of intellectual property rights. Cantor said that Brazil, India, and Thailand have failed to protect American trademarks, patents, and copyrights and have allowed pirated goods into their markets. Cantor said that all three countries have been identified as priorities for action under the International Property Section of U.S. trade law. The trade chief said he'd decide by the end of May what actions should be taken. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. This weekend may bring us a step closer to ending the war in the former Yugoslavia, or it may set the stage for a widening war. The leaders of the three warring factions in Bosnia will resume peace talks this weekend. President Clinton is expected to decide sometime tomorrow whether he will call for American military intervention. Earlier this week, we heard from two people who passionately believe it is our moral responsibility to use military force to stop the genocide in Bosnia. My guest, Misha Glenny, is passionate in his opposition to military intervention. Glenny is covering the war for the BBC, and he's the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia, which just received the Overseas Press Club Award for the best book on foreign affairs. Misha Glenny is certain that outside military intervention would only lead to a wider, bloodier war. He says comparisons to the Holocaust don't hold.
The fact of the matter is that unlike many comparisons which are made, this is not the situation in the Balkans is not like Germany in the 1930s. This is not like Nazi imperialism. It's an extremely inaccurate and misleading historical parallel. What this is a number of nations attempting to form nation states by force in the wake of the collapse of the former Yugoslavia. Now, obviously, the Serbs are chiefly responsible for most of the violence. There's no question about that. But they are not the only ones responsible. President Tudjman of Croatia must bear considerable responsibility. And indeed, there are radicals in the leadership of the Muslims who have always encouraged the idea of war in the hope that they will receive weapons, i.e. they have been prepared to sacrifice their own civilian populations because they thought that this would lead to a supply of arms to them. Now, in that sense, nobody bears full responsibility, and the Croats bear a lot of responsibility for this war in particular. So if you aim your airstrikes at one side, against one side, that is against the Serbs, what you're going to do is you're going to get a sense of real grievance among the Serbs, and they are likely to provoke further conflict elsewhere. But in addition, the Croats, the Muslims, and the Albanians in Kosovo are all going to see this as a sign of potential weakness amongst the Serbs, and they will make their move and try and form their nation states at the expense of the Serbs, and so the whole thing will widen and will become much, much worse.
So the picture you're painting sounds like there's a lot of leaders who, for opportunistic reasons, almost want military intervention, and the people will suffer.
Of course they do. The point is that, you know, if you were to arm the Muslims sufficiently, for example, what they would do is they would go through eastern Bosnia in the Serb-held areas and do unto the Serb civilians what the Serbs have already done to them. That means you would be getting a sort of leveling of the atrocities, basically. And that's all very well. It may, you know, I mean, the Serbs may deserve it for being such pigs in eastern Bosnia, but it's hardly a sort of moral response to a moral outrage, is to say, well, the only response to that is to allow them to do the same thing. You know, I don't think that moral argument works in the slightest. Also, you know, how if you're going to lift the arms embargo, for example, how do you get them to the Muslims? You'd have to get them through the Croatian lines. Now, the Croats have stated quite openly and publicly that they will not allow a single bullet to get through to the Muslims, because, as we know, the Muslims and Croats are now fighting in large parts of central Bosnia. So the only way you can get them through is to send them in by aircraft. Now, if you were to send in arms by aircraft to the Muslims, then the Serbs and the Croats will fire at you, and that means that we would be at war with Serbia and Croatia, and I think that's a very dangerous position to get ourselves into.
So you strongly oppose lifting the arms embargo?
I strongly oppose anything other than a commitment, first of all, to the Vance Owen plan, which has been lacking, particularly amongst the Clinton administration, although if you actually look at what the Clinton administration is now advocating, it is nothing other than the Vance Owen plan. The point about the Vance Owen plan, which is really important to make, let's scotch one or two myths. Clinton came in at the beginning of his administration. He says, we're not going to go with the Vance Owen plan because it legitimizes ethnic cleansing and it appeases Serbian aggression. This is sheer hogwash. It actually punishes the Serbs and makes them hand back 60% of the territory that they have conquered militarily in the past year, including many of the towns that they have cleansed. And so the reason why the Croats and the Muslims have signed the Vance plan is because it's in their interest to do so. It is not in the interest of the Serbs, and that's why they haven't signed it. But the Clinton administration should have given the Vance Owen plan their full backing. Secondly, the UN troops on the ground need much more commitment. They need to have a stronger mandate. They need to fire back if they're fired upon. And above all else, we need to get a large number of United Nations troops inside the threatened cities like Srebrenica, Gorazde, Dzepa, and so on and so forth. They must disarm the militias in those towns that they are protecting, and then they must create de facto safe havens. In that way, the Serbs or whoever is attacking a particular safe haven cannot claim that the United Nations is protecting a militia. They will be protecting civilians and civilians alone. And so that is the only intervention that we should have as a way of creating a gradual air of demilitarization. If you do anything else, all you're going to do is to lead to a massive escalation of the war. And it's all very well for the Americans to go in and say, right, we'll hit a few Serb targets and then we'll pull back to New York and Washington. What I want to know is going to happen to the millions of Albanians, Macedonians, Serbs, Hungarians, and or whoever who are going to get caught up in a bloodbath.
I know you said that it's really not fair to compare what's happening in the former Yugoslavia now to what happened in Germany during the Second World War, but it does seem, at least you know, from the perspective of the United States sitting here, it does seem that there is genocide being attempted in Bosnia, and genocide is a pretty convincing argument for military intervention.
Yes, but what we have to realize is that why is that genocide happening? It is not happening as part of a plan which was, first of all, was conceived over a decade ago, as Adolf Hitler did in the early 1920s in preparation for the final solution. That genocide is what happens every single time territorial disputes in the Balkans move from peaceful, are articulated no longer through peaceful means, but through armed conflict. Then the minority populations in any territory becomes a strategic threat to those people fighting. And this always happens in the Balkans. I can read you reports from the Carnegie Commission on the First and Second Balkan Wars, published in 1914, which could have come out of yesterday's New York Times, because they're identical. Whenever the Balkans goes up, these sorts of atrocities happen. Secondly, the West bears substantial responsibility for this war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. It bears it primarily because Germany insisted on the premature recognition of Croatia. Once you recognize Croatia prematurely, then Bosnia-Herzegovina, which is not in a position politically to constitute itself as an independent state, Bosnia-Herzegovina stands at the mercy of imperial wishes not only in Belgrade but also in Zagreb, i.e. the Serbs and the Croats both. Secondly, when the European community told the Bosnians that they could have an independent state if they held a referendum and there was a simple 51% majority, which then went ahead. They violated the central constitutional principle in Bosnia-Herzegovina, which guarantees peace. That is the principle of three constituent nations. You cannot make constitutional changes in Bosnia, either without having all of the parties agreeing to it, or without the outbreak of war. And that was inevitable. It was written. People were warning against it. Saj Vance warned against it. Perez de Cuellar warned against it. Alija Izetbegovic, the Bosnian president, went to Bonn in December 1991 and begged with Chancellor Kohl and Hans-Dietrich Genscher not to recognize Croatia because it was a death sentence for Bosnia-Herzegovina. So we aren't in a position to talk about principled solutions in this conflict or just solutions, because we have acted unprincipled and screwed things up ourselves in the first place. And so we cannot blame the Serbs exclusively. We have to try and stop war going on there and not to increase it by an emotive response to the atrocities.
I understand that you're saying we bear some of the responsibility for what's happening there, but when the actions that you're talking about started, there wasn't genocide, and now there is attempted genocide, and the United States is one of the signatories to a pact that says that we will that we will try to prevent genocide. I mean, isn't it a responsibility?
I understand what you're saying. I'm afraid I have to contradict you, though. Perhaps in the United States, people weren't so interested in the Yugoslav conflict as I remember from June 1991 onwards, although I do make the very honorable exception of NPR, which I think has covered this war very well. But let me tell you, from the minute that this war started in Croatia in June 1991, the Croats and Serbs were cleansing each other left, right, and center, not only in the war zones, but in civilian zones, close to the war zones, like Zagreb, Zadar, Karlovac, and so on. This is nothing new. Now, I understand that the most appalling things are going on in Bosnia-Herzegovina. I have witnessed them with my own eye. I have talked to the victims. I have seen the bodies, and it is the most bestial, ghastly thing that I have ever witnessed in my whole life, nor am I ever likely to. However, if we respond incorrectly, remember that the Western community, the international community, both Europe and the United States, has screwed up monumentally from the very outbreak of this war. If we do it again, if we make a mistake this time, we're not talking about what remains, despite all the horror, a localized war in the Balkans, that is one restricted to the peripheral areas of Croatia and the whole of Bosnia-Herzegovina. We're talking about a massive conflagration across the whole of southeastern Europe, implicating Greece and Turkey, not to mention the possibility of it spreading up north through Hungary, and not to mention what the impact of this is going to be on Russia. And so, you know, however ghastly it is in Bosnia-Herzegovina, our priority is to stop the balloon going up in southeastern Europe, because we will be heading then towards a massive destabilization of the European continent. And so in that sense, however ghastly what's happening to the Muslims is, what we must concentrate on doing is, first of all, stopping a Balkan war, secondly, protecting the civilians and not supporting the Muslim militia in any way. We have to protect the civilians, and that's why safe havens is a good idea, because it stops the genocide.
You're making a distinction between supporting Muslim militias and supporting Muslim citizens with the arms embargo.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, don't let the Muslims protect themselves by giving them weapons, because they will use that to commit new atrocities, this time on the Serbs. Although, you know, again, one thing that hasn't been pointed out in the press here very readily is that the fighting in central Bosnia going on at the moment is not largely the Croats' responsibility. It is largely the Muslims' responsibility. And although there have been some dramatic pictures of the Croats cleansing the Muslims, there have been equally dramatic events of Muslims cleansing Croats and hounding families out of their homes by the hundred, which have got have not been reported at all. The Muslims, you know, understandably, because they're so traumatized, they are no angels. So do not give it to those people who will just commit further atrocities. Concentrate on the real problem, which is the civilian population, i.e. the victims.
My guest is journalist Misha Glenny. He's been covering the war in the former Yugoslavia for the BBC. He's also the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia, the Third Balkan War, which just received the Overseas Press Award for the best book on foreign affairs. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to an interview recorded earlier today with journalist Misha Glenny. You're very confident that if Europe and the United States intervene militarily, that the war will spread. Where do you think it would go, and how do you think, what do you think the pattern would be?
Well, first of all, I think that in particular that Croatia would take advantage of disarray amongst the Serbs, and that they would attempt to reestablish militarily their sovereignty over the Serb-occupied areas of Croatia. If that happens, you have a revival of what's called the large-scale Serb-Croat War, which we haven't yet seen this time round. We've only seen the small-scale Serb-Croat War. What will happen is that the Yugoslav army will move against Croatia. In all probability, it will bomb Zagreb, and the Croats, who, despite the arms embargo, have newly acquired missiles, will do the same to Belgrade, and you have a full-scale war not only in Croatia but also in Bosnia-Herzegovina. Not to mention the fact that, you know, I mean, the Serbs would respond, and indeed possibly the Croats would respond to any outside military force, the United Nations or so on and so forth. They'd see this as the occupier and the enemy. What we have to do now, rather than talking about intervention, is make sure this damn meeting in Athens works over the weekend, and make sure Milosevic twists the arms or breaks the arms of Karadzic and the Bosnian Serbs in their parliament, and get them to accept the Vance-Owen plan. If we can do that, we have a peaceful way, at least a breathing space, out of this Balkan crisis. Any other road leads to a massive conflagration.
Can't you make the argument that the threat of military force would be a good incentive for the leaders who are meeting in Greece this weekend to reach some kind of agreement?
Well, it would be if you say, you know, not only are we going to take out Serb artillery, but we're going to take out Croat artillery as well. But because, you know, the point is the Croats haven't committed anything like the amount of atrocities that the Serbs have. But militarily and politically, they've done exactly the same thing. They have, which is what Izetbegovic has accused them of. And so, you know, it has to be any sort of threat of military force has to be one which is backed by a commitment to neutrality in what is essentially a civil war in Bosnia-Herzegovina. And that's the only type that is going to work. But if, you know, if the West were to say, look, we're really fed up with all of you, you all lie, you all cheat, you know, and this is something, for example, that the State Department doesn't realize. It believes that the Muslims, for some particular reason, have escaped all the traditions of Balkan politics, that they are honest, that they are wide-eyed, that they are peace-loving, and so on and so forth. Of course they're not. They're schooled in the same type of politics as Milosevic and Tudjman are. And yet that's something that the State Department refuses to recognize. But if we were to go to Athens and say, look, you're all a bunch of duplicitous fools who are driving not only yourselves but all your nations and the entire region into an unholy mess, and we've had enough of it, and we're going to put 200,000 ground troops into Bosnia-Herzegovina, we're going to demilitarize the whole area, and we're going to stop you fighting, that would have more credibility with those leaders than standing up and saying, right, if the Serbs don't sign this, we're going to bomb them. That simply does not have, that just excites everybody on the ground. And what we should be doing is calming them down.
You seem to think that the Vance-Owen peace plan is a workable plan if people signed on to it. I've heard a lot of people say that the only thing you can say in favor of the peace plan is that it exists and there's no competition, But it's not a very workable plan.
Well, you know, they have to say, in what way is it not workable? Of course, it's not ideal, but then, you know, we created this situation by recognizing Croatia in the first place. So it's not ideal, it's a sticking plaster. Of course it's a sticking plaster, but what does it do? First of all, it guarantees a sense of Bosnian sovereignty. There will be a national country called Bosnia-Herzegovina. Secondly, it does not appease aggression, because the Serbs' aim would be to break off from Bosnia-Herzegovina and restore constitutional links with Serbia. Now, the Vanceoven plan states quite categorically that the Serb-dominated areas may not form relations with other countries, i.e. Serbia, independently of the government of Bosnia-Herzegovina. So it doesn't appease aggression in that sense. If the plan is properly enforced, then all the results of cleansing will be reversed, because everybody will have the right to go back to their home, and that right will be guaranteed by the good offices of the United Nations. Now, politically, obviously, these 10 decentralized provinces are problematic in certain response, and it's not going to be easy, and it is not the ultimate solution to the problems posed by Bosnia-Herzegovina and the Balkans. But we do not have any other options. We do not, but this is an option which genuinely has a possibility of functioning. We also have to remember that these are very, very complex disputes, historically based, running back 180 years, not centuries as most people like to think, and that any solution to this problem is going to take years to implement now. It's going to take a very, very long time. And those who are expecting things to stop overnight, whether it's by bombing, whether it's by the Vanceoven plan, or whether it's by letting them get on and liquidate one another, those of us who expect that are unfortunately extremely misguided as to what is going on in Eastern Europe and the Balkans. The end of the Cold War is a historical explosion which has unleashed all sorts of profound problems based on the difficulties of territory and minorities, and it's going to take us decades to get this sorted out. But the more that we the more we provoke the situation over there, the more we risk screwing up and starting a war which could lead to a European war in the end.
The next few days are going to be critical in deciding what happens next. Can you just review for us what is about to happen? Clinton is going to be meeting with his advisors tomorrow, and we're told that sometime tomorrow he'll probably have a decision on what he thinks the United States policy should be. Now, what's going to be happening in Greece?
Well, I obviously this is going to be a very delicate weekend diplomatically. Clearly, David Owen and Cyrus Vance were hoping that Clinton would postpone any decision until after the weekend. Whether Clinton is going to decide but not reveal it until after the weekend is not entirely clear at the moment. But obviously, if they're in a delicate set of negotiations and the administration announces that it will be lifting the arms embargo, then the temptation for the Muslims to walk out of the agreement of the talks would simply be overwhelming. They'll say, right, well, that's it, we can go because we're getting weapons on Monday, and so we can fight our way out of this. So I think there will be an attempt by the co-chairman to request a postponement of any announcement by Clinton. What will be happening in Athens itself is we've got to get a deal very, very quickly, because a lot of people are impatient, both from the international community and from amongst the warring factions and from Croatia and Serbia. And so if some sort of commitment to a peaceful deal isn't sorted out within the first day or within the first day and a half of these talks, then I think that things are likely to collapse and the future looks very, very black.
Misha Glenny spoke to us from New York. He returns to the Balkans Monday. Glenny is covering the war for the BBC. He's also the author of the book The Fall of Yugoslavia, The Third Balkan War. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Jerry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, we meet a Serbian dissident writer and a writer from Sarajevo who is part Serb, part Muslim. They've just received the Freedom to Write Award from PEN, the International Writers Organization. They're both now living in exile in Slovenia. Also, Stephen Schiff reviews Bound by Honor, a new movie about Chicano culture in East L.A. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. At the UN, international negotiator David Owen said today the chances for peace in Bosnia are the best that he's seen in months. However, he also warned that there is still no guarantee that the Bosnian Serb parliament will approve a peace plan. NPR's Trevor Rowe reports.
Owen says the combination of tightened economic sanctions and possible use of military force has caused Serbian leader Slobodan Milosevic to shift positions and back a negotiated solution. During an interview, he said Milosevic is now pressuring Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic to sign the peace plan worked out by himself and former U.S. Secretary of State Cyrus Vance. Owen predicts Karadzic will, in the end, be forced to sign the plan.
Ultimately, I think that he will have to recognize where power lies, and power lies in Belgrade.
Owen allowed that the Bosnian Serb Assembly could still oppose the plan when it meets to vote on it next Wednesday. He also suggested he would have preferred if Washington delayed its decision on whether to use military force against the Bosnian Serbs until after the vote. This is Trevor Rowe in New York.
In Washington, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators is pledging to support President Clinton if he decides to seek multinational airstrikes against Serbs in Bosnia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
16 senators signed a letter to the president today saying they and other unsigned lawmakers would support lifting the arms embargo on the Bosnian Muslims and launching multinational airstrikes. Michigan Democrat Carl Levin, the letter's principal author, says the senators know there are great risks involved if the United States takes military action.
We also feel that there are risks in not acting, and that if we do not act, that aggression could spread to other parts of Europe, and that ethnic cleansing could spread to other parts of Europe and to the former Soviet Union.
All the senators oppose sending U.S. ground troops to Bosnia. The president is expected to come to a decision over the use of military force over the weekend. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The number one ranked women's tennis player in the world, Monica Seles, was stabbed in the back by a spectator at a match in Hamburg, Germany today. Police say the Serbian-born tennis star was not seriously injured, but was taken to the hospital for treatment. Seles is now based in Florida and has been quoted as saying the fighting in the former Yugoslavia is not her concern. She reportedly has received death threats in the past. Seles was playing for the first time in a tennis tournament after a 9-week break due to a virus. In New York City on Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up more than 2 points to close at 3,427.55 on volume of more than 239 million shares. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 2-1 in very heavy trading. This is NPR News. Secretary of Defense Les Aspin has fired the Air Force general who was in charge of the C-17 cargo plane program. At the same time, the secretary disciplined two other generals and a civilian in connection with a program which has had $1.5 billion in cost overruns. In a memo to the acting secretary of the Air Force, Aspen said if the system is to work, then those charged with responsibility for the management of billion-dollar systems have to perform to the highest standards. 15 Palestinians exiled by Israel before the Intifada returned to a rousing welcome in the West Bank today. In Jerusalem, NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Thousands of Palestinians waited all day in the hot sun for their friends and relatives to cross the Allenby Bridge from Jordan into the West Bank. When they finally arrived, the crowd went wild. The 15 are among 30 that Israel said could return. It was one of the Israeli gestures that convinced the Palestinians to return to the peace talks. Palestinians say it is an important first step, but Israel must continue to return other exiles, including almost 400 expelled in December as suspected Islamic militants. Among today's returnees are the former president of Bir Zeit University and the former mayor of the West Bank town of El Bira. Their return is expected to strengthen the pro-PLO forces which support the peace process. I'm Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
The government says that personal income moved up 0.6% in March, but most of this came in farm subsidies. At the same time, consumer spending was off for the first time in 7 months. The Commerce Department says that there were two strong factors in March, an expansion in farm owners' income and uninsured housing damage that was caused by a major East Coast storm. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Two writers from the former Yugoslavia have just won Freedom to Write awards from PEN, the International Writers Organization. They've each opposed the rise of nationalism in the Balkans. They're both pacifists and oppose military intervention because they think it would only expand the war. Zoran Mutic is from Sarajevo. He's the son of a Muslim mother and a Serbian father. He's the former president of the Association of Literary Translators in Bosnia. He left Sarajevo just before the city came under siege. He now lives in exile in Slovenia, where he's editing a journal for refugees. Svetlana Slapshak is a Serbian dissident writer and former president of the Committee for Liberty of Expression. She, too, is living in exile in Slovenia, teaching at the University of Ljubljana. In fact, she helped bring Mutic to Slovenia by recommending him for a teaching position. She told me there's still a dissident movement in Belgrade, where she used to live.
There are independent periodicals and weeklies like Republika and Vreme, really very critical about the regime all the time, something like 3 years since they started. Then there is the independent radio, then there Studio B, then there's an independent TV station. There are many, many ways to express what you feel in Belgrade. In other words, you can tell whatever you want. And somehow, you know, Belgrade is isolated. It's a huge concentration intellectual camp in which you can say anything and it really doesn't work. So my friends that are still in Belgrade really feel desperate because they say that what they say to each other, it's an autotherapy. It's not action. And I must say that the embargo imposed on Serbia in last year was a catastrophe for the opposition.
Why did the sanctions hurt the dissident movement in Belgrade?
Because they couldn't reach the world, because they were closed, most of them could not travel, most of them could not dispatch their periodicals and their articles. It's a great struggle to be heard outside of Belgrade.
Were you sorry when further sanctions went into effect earlier this week?
No. No, frankly, no. Sanctions have this moral impact, which is really very important and which should be imposed. And I only wish that most of the people that I know get out. Being Serb, well, I admit I became Serb when this war started because I feel the need to express that I'm a different Serb, that there are different Serbs that don't go with this stupid war, and that feel a need to repent, to say that they feel guilty, and that there are Serbs that think about future, very simply.
That's very interesting. In the past, you were so kind of fed up with ethnic fighting and nationalism that you declared yourself an ethnic Martian. But when
right.
this war broke out, you wanted to be a Serb so that you could be
yes.
a Serbian dissident.
Yes.
And prove that there was a different kind of Serb.
Right.
Did you have a lot of friends, colleagues who felt the same way?
Yes. Something, well, at least a few thousand people in Belgrade.
Are there intellectuals who you know who defend Milosevic?
Yes.
And what reasons do they have?
Power.
Whose power?
Power of being in the system. Well, the socialist system was instrumentalized in many different ways. And one of the ways was to collect as many people as they can, as many names as they can. So many writers went with the regime in order to obtain some privileges, in order to be the part of nomenklatura. Well, the same processes continued with the nationalist program. So many nationalist intellectuals that were not dissidents at all, but joined the general dissident feeling in the late 80s, understood that going with Milosevic would give them more power than anything else. So they followed him. And I'm afraid that there's a generation, deep generation, and if you want, deep gender gap, men, older men, poets and intellectuals were the most eager to follow Milosevic.
Is there a student movement? Student
yes.
dissident movement?
Yes, there is a student dissident movement, but it doesn't work anymore because I think that most of the students who were active 1 year before now fled away because they don't see any future. Some of them are still in Belgrade wearing badges like... it's non-translatable, and it's in rhymes, but I have a BA and I want to leave, and things like that, you know. They make queues before the embassies, they ask for visas, and they go anywhere. South Africa, Zambia, New Zealand, anywhere.
Do you still have family in Belgrade?
Yes, well, my mother is half in Belgrade, half in Ljubljana. Now she's in Ljubljana, and I'm very happy about it because she's safer there. She's rather old. She lost her house in Croatia. We lost everything we ever had. Now it might happen that we lose the apartment in Belgrade, too, with all our possessions there. But okay.
She lost everything in Croatia during World War II?
No, in this war.
Oh.
30 years ago, she built a house on the Croatian coast. She was very happy there. She spent something like 6 months every year there. And last summer, they told her she should leave immediately. And she lost it. She had to leave. So it's, 50 years after, she lost again. But nowadays, you can't hear anything like national hate from her. She said, okay, crazy people like in every war. She still hopes to get it back.
Do you have other family in Belgrade?
No, just friends, very dear friends.
My guest is Serbian dissident writer Svetlana Slapshak. More after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Svetlana Slapshak and Zoran Mutic, two writers from the former Yugoslavia who just won Freedom to Write awards from PEN, the International Writers Organization. I want to get back to something you were saying before. You were saying that now you're calling yourself a Serb because you're a Serb dissident, and you want to show that it's possible to be a Serb and be a dissident, to oppose the slaughter that's taking place now. As a Serb in Slovenia, are there a lot of suspicions about you? Is there any stereotyping of you, even though you're a dissident?
Yes, of course there are. Something must be explained also. If you say now that you are Yugoslav in former Yugoslavia, this is despised by all sides. Everybody feels awful about Yugoslavia. So there's no country, there's no use of calling yourself Yugoslav. There's a term invented by Croat press, which is a very depressing one, but I use it in an ironic sense, Yugo-zombie. Yes, I feel like Yugo-zombie. I don't want to forget good sides of the life which prevailed in former Yugoslavia, and I don't want to forget how awful the system was against what I fought. So I don't forget neither one or other. But when I declare myself Serb, that's a risk in Slovenia, that's true. And I've been attacked of being a primitive Balkan female, of being not knowing how to behave in somebody else's house, and so on and so on. I was named Homo erectus and not Homo sapiens, and so on and so on. But why? There's a very concrete reason why. I signed a petition a year ago, actually I ideated it, that the former Yugoslavs should be given all the citizenships in the new Yugoslav states, as many as they want. I mean, this would solve all the problems of possession in other republics, mixed marriages, love affairs, friendships, and so on and so on. And in the case that the international community cannot provide that, perhaps we could get European passports or something like that. And generally, it might sound very desperate, but I think that the only really positive and active thing that the international community can invest into Yugoslavia is to help people out of Yugoslavia, Yugoslav refugees, especially young ones, to educate. And perhaps to establish some intellectual institutions like universities for Balkan studies outside Yugoslavia to form the new multi-ethnic, multi-linguistic circle of young men who would be able to rethink the whole thing again.
Zoran Mutic, you were born in Sarajevo.
Yes.
What do you think the chances are you'll ever go home to Sarajevo?
I don't know if there is a possibility to get some other passport, or let's say a Slovenian passport. I could go tomorrow as a Slovenian citizen and not be molested if the war stopped tomorrow, let's say. But I will probably do something like that, at least to see the people I love, to be for a while with them, to take my books and other things that are dear to me, I don't know, some photographs, albums, things like this. But I really do not wish to go back. I know maybe it is not noble enough to say something like this for a town that has been destroyed when everybody should go back and help rebuild it. But I don't want to go back because the atmosphere has changed. Most of the good people have either fled or have again turned to this or that side. Most of my friends, it is usually the people, it's not the buildings and the surroundings, mountains, however beautiful. It's usually the people that attract you to a place and keep you tied to a place. Some of them have changed, some of them, as I said, have fled from Sarajevo. So to go back and just see two or three or ten of them and to stay there for the rest of my life just because there are five or six of them, when I think I can help both Sarajevo and Bosnia by being outside and working for them, like with this refugee magazine that we are making now.
Tell me something about the refugee magazine.
Well, it's intended not only to connect the lost ties between, to make ties between, which were cut, between families, relatives, friends, but also to keep them informed on everything of concern, on their legal rights, on other issues like giving them medical, psychiatric advice, teaching them the language of the new environment, and also giving them an opportunity to express themselves creatively by writing and drawing, especially for the children and for the older ones, their literary sites, pages with novels, poems, etc. There news which are not immediately, which are not the news they get from the everyday press and from radio and TV, but which concern them more, let's say, on a wider basis, etc.
It sounds almost as if your equivalent of an ethnic identity now is your identity as an exile.
Yeah.
that the group that you really identify with is the exile and the refugee.
Yeah.
And the people in that community are of all the different ethnic backgrounds.
Yes.
And it sounds, too, like you're afraid that the war has perhaps permanently destroyed the cosmopolitan pluralistic nature of Sarajevo.
That is definite. Unfortunately, but I'm certain of that. One of the things is that most of the, or let's say from the facts we know, those who had the chance to flee have fled. And it's at least one-third of the population. On the other hand, this one-third of the population was replaced by a huge number of refugees from the surrounding villages. And, you know, to suddenly change 100,000 people with 200,000 newcomers with other customs and without the urban culture, let's say, by itself somehow implies the drastic change.
One last question. These ethnic hatreds in the Balkans keep rising to the surface again, then they die down for a while and they rise to the surface again. Have you ever wanted to leave the Balkans altogether, or do you feel a commitment to stay?
Yeah, well, I like to leave from time to time, but somehow I'm not only compelled to stay, I feel it as a challenge.
And Svetlana?
Well, one of my topics at the university, I teach Balkanology. I adore Balkans, including Greece. I don't want to leave Balkans forever, but I want to be around. And if I could choose, of course, I would like to live 6 months in Paris and 6 months in Balkans, any part of Balkans, especially Greece. That would be ideal, which is not possible. So, what I feel a need to say something about Zoran, if you let me. Zoran lives with us in the same apartment, which is not the biggest one, and he sleeps in the kitchen for 1 year now. On a folding bed. I mean, he lives like a dog and he works like a dog. We all do, in a way. And I think that his heroism is of a very special kind, you know. He never mentions the situation in which he is emotionally. He even doesn't have pictures of his people, you know, his folks. And this is a very desperate situation, but we're trying to make it worth by inventing something else. And one thing that we invented and that exists now are our students, Slovenian students, which are absolutely brilliant. And the house is full of students every time of the day, and it's a very happy atmosphere, I must say. Healthy, happy, and very poor. This is how we survive. That's our therapy, and I wouldn't go from Ljubljana only if the pressure is really important, and only if I'm deprived of all of my students, and only if all of my students turn back on us. So we need a real catastrophe to go from there.
Zoran, you have no pictures of your family because you weren't able to take them with you?
Yeah, because, as I said, somehow I hope that I would return in a 2 or 3 months, 4 months, but I didn't have anything. All my books are still in Sarajevo.
Well, I wish you both good luck, and I thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Svetlana Slapshak and Zoran Mutic just received Freedom to Write awards from PEN, the International Writers Organization. This is Fresh Air. This promises to be a critical weekend in deciding the next step in the war in the former Yugoslavia. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what we have on All Things Considered?
We'll have a report from Ann Garrows here in Washington about what the Clinton administration is thinking about, what they're debating in the way of a new policy toward Bosnia. We'll also be hearing in today's program from Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem about the scene as 15 Palestinians who had been deported from the occupied territories returned home across the Allenby Bridge today in a rare moment of conciliation by Israel toward the Palestinians and the territories. Also, Noah Adams interviews poet Carolyn Forché about a new anthology she's collected, and Wade Goodwin on charges of child abuse inside the Branch Davidian compound.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director Taylor Hackford hit it big in 1982 with his second feature, An Officer and a Gentleman. Since then, he's made the movies Against All Odds, White Knights, and Everybody's All-American. But he hasn't managed to come up with a big hit. His latest film is an epic about two decades of Chicano life in East L.A. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of Bound by Honor.
Was it only a year ago that Edward James Olmos released American Me, his epic about Chicano gangs and prison and how life on the streets connects with life behind bars? That movie was wildly heavy-handed, but Bound by Honor makes it look like restoration comedy. This picture never talks when it can scream, and it screams and screams for 3 full hours. What Hackford and his battery of screenwriters were probably trying to do was make a kind of opera without a score, along the lines of Luchino Visconti's great film Rocco and His Brothers. In fact, Bound by Honor is about three young guys who have grown up as brothers in East L.A. Cruz is the artistic one. His half-brother Paco is the volatile tough guy. And their cousin Miklo is the movie's real protagonist. He's a blue-eyed blonde with a white father and a Chicana mother, but he owes his deepest loyalty to the barrio. The movie discovers these three in 1972. We watch them get embroiled in neighborhood gang battles that swing out of control until Cruz is crippled, Paco's forced to join the Marines to avoid jail, and blonde Miklo winds up at San Quentin doing hard time. There he finds three gangs of inmates vying for power, the white Aryan Vanguard, the black guerrilla army, and the Chicano group known as La Onda. Miklo wants to be a part of La Onda, but the gang's leader won't have him. Not, that is, until Miklo makes this big, windy speech.
All my life I've been kept out. You know what that feels like? Knowing you're a Chicano and no one accepts you because your skin came out white? My mom's as brown as you are. And my white dad tried to beat every ounce of her out of me. But you know what? He couldn't do it. Chicano's not a color. It's the way you think and the way you live. And if you're willing to give up your life for carnal.
Big, windy speeches are a lot of what Bound by Honor is all about. Speeches about Chicano pride, about fighting for your people, about united we stand, divided we fall. The actors are almost all unknown, and you can see why. Out of a cast of lots and lots, the only performances that don't make you writhe are some of the ones by veteran character actors like Delroy Lindo and Tom Towles, playing scary-looking inmates. The scenes at San Quentin were actually shot there, and once you get used to the movie's hysteria, they're fairly gripping. The film's designers have supplied a panoply of spooky-looking tattoos. Every convict gets at least a dozen. And all the details, from the withered pork chops at lunch to the bad art on the cell walls, feel authentic. It's just the performances that don't. At the heart of both this movie and American Me is a fascinating message about the way gang life outside of prison is ruled by gang life within. But both films are so overblown and feverish that they deny the authenticity of their subject matter. Chicano gang life in Los Angeles is worthy of an epic, but an epic needs a great storyteller. I only hope that Bound by Honor hasn't finally obliterated the chances for some Chicano Francis Coppola to emerge and tell this tale the way it should be told once and for all.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our engineers this week are Audrey Voblaitis, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, British mystery writer Liza Cody tells us why she created a new heroine who's a wrestler and is big, bad, and ugly. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.